In the news.
Howdy, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for Introduction to American Government.
Week number one.
That's right.
All right, so I think we got five of these that we're going to fire up throughout the course of the session. This is our initial foray into this territory. So hopefully you guys are excited about the course. I know we are. A couple things we wanted to mention at the outset, just so everybody's on the same page. First of all, and this is our default response to almost anything you guys will ask us over the course of the semester when it comes to logistics or the kind of the mechanics of the course, please refer to the syllabus. So when it comes to your assignments, due dates, evaluations and materials, office hours, consult the syllabus. If after reading the syllabus you have questions, feel free to email Professor McDaniel or myself or the TAs. We have two TAs associated with the course and they're crackerjack. So we should be able to communicate any kind of information that is not clear as soon as you send us an email. A little bit of a caveat here. Please don't use Canvas to email us. The Canvas communication system's a little, you know, kind of hinky anyway. And the emails in particular are difficult. Sometimes you hit reply and it doesn't go to the correct address or you guys don't check the Canvas box. Just don't. Just email us directly at our UT email addresses. Two other things real briefly with respect to housekeeping. Please, we encourage you, if you haven't already, sign up for Proctor U. One of the really nice things about this course is that you can basically access it anywhere. The flip side to that is when it comes to the evaluations, we have to use Proctor U. Well, we don't have to, but it is easily the most convenient way to make sure that everybody can take the exam wherever they happen to be. So we're using Proctor U. Please sign up for Proctor U. And then finally, if any of you require SSD accommodations, please contact us and the TAs as soon as possible so we can set something up for you. All right, so with that, I think that's kind of the gamut here.
Yeah.
So, all right, so we're going to get right into the substance. We use these in the news segments, as is described in the syllabus, to talk about what's going on currently in American politics or sometimes world politics, and hopefully to connect what's in the news today with what you guys are reading, listening to in viewing in our modules, in our lecture assignments. So this is in the news number one. We're going to be doing this while you guys are reading information, listening to information, viewing information on the Constitution, federalism, the relationship between Congress and the presidency and how the framers kind of set this bizarre experiment we call American government out. So we're not only going to talk about a few things that occurred in the news this week, but to try to bring them directly back to some of the core concepts that we're exploring in the lecture material. So with that, we're going to hit three big topics today. We're going to talk about the president and the Congress, Donald Trump and the Congress, and some things that are going on right now. We're going to talk about trade wars, tariffs, and regulating tech briefly, again, with an eye towards some of these institutional relationships in American government. And then finally, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the abortion controversies. So we want to make sure for those of you who, this is one of those topics that could warrant a trigger warning. We're not going to, get into the details of abortion, certainly, but we are going to talk about kind of the law with respect to abortion and the relationship between the Supreme Court and the Congress and the states and the federal government. So that'll be the last topic. We're going to hit all three, and with that, let me toss it to Professor McDaniel. I know you have some thoughts on the Congress and the president.
All right. Yeah, so I guess we have good news and kind of bad news. Let me start off with the good news. One of the things that's important to note is that while President Trump has had an adversarial relationship with Congress, even when the Republicans had control of both the House and the Senate, it's kind of intensified now that the Democrats have control of the House. That they were able to pass the natural disaster bill. And so this is something that's been delayed by quite a bit, but this will provide resources to Puerto Rico, also the states and areas affected by hurricanes in the fall of 2018, but also to the Midwestern states and the Plain states that are being affected by flooding. So this is a sign of some success in terms of the president being able to work with Congress. You could argue that in regards to relief for Puerto Rico, it took too long, but this is a sign of success and some action being taken. But What we do have are some, we do have some problems. In particular, we find that President Trump has had a hard time working with Congress. He had a hard time working with Congress even when the Republicans were in control of the House and the Senate. But now that the Democrats are in control of the House, they are kind of ramping up a lot of kind of animosity or antagonism towards President Trump. So you had the various investigations. You can look at the various hearings they've had with members of his cabinet. And so this is really increasing, but it is really increasing some level of antagonism between him and the House. The Senate, not so much. But the House of Representatives has really been using their power to hold hearings, to bring many of the tactics of President Trump, as well as members of his administration, under question. So you can think of the interview with Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson. You can think of Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos's testimonies. You can think of the number of testimonies regarding the Mueller report. So what we have here is a problem where Congress, or at least the House of Representatives, has been somewhat antagonistic towards the president, and the president vice versa, and it's going to be difficult to see if anything gets through. So much like we saw kind of like the past couple years of Obama's administration, where he and the House, particularly the House of Representatives, and to some degree the Senate, were kind of antagonistic with each other, we've seen the same thing going on with President Trump within his first term. And so while it was rocky when Republicans had control, it's even worse now that Democrats have control of the House. And so it'll be interesting to see what comes forward, specifically with increased calls for impeachment, with increased calls for investigations, and basically kind of really openly questioning the ethics of the president, but also whether or not he's been engaging in certain legal activities. One thing Congress has tried to do, at least the House has tried to do, is sue to stop certain levels of funding going towards the border wall. A judge struck down that suit just the other day. And so there are a lot of things going on where you're seeing really the two branches not working together. And again, what's important to note is when you're dealing with Congress, you're dealing with the House and the Senate. And so the Senate may be on your side for certain things. So that's why he's been able to get judicial confirmations. That's been very helpful for him. The House, when he wants to get certain bills through, wants to get a budget through, he has to be able to work with the House. And the House has been antagonistic towards him. So it's going to be interesting to see how this takes shape, given that, you know, you have really these increased calls for impeachment, these increased calls for more investigations. And so you should expect an increasingly antagonistic relationship between President Trump and specifically the House. It has not boiled over to the Senate. The Senate, for the most part, has worked well with President Trump. But as long as the Democrats control the House, you should expect an antagonistic relationship.
Hmm. Well, let's see. I want to make a couple of points referent to this. So the big picture question is, you know, the current relationship between the President of the United States and the Congress. But, you know, you all are reading about constitutional design and checks and balances. So a couple of things that are relevant here. It is the case, as Professor McDaniel mentioned, that legislation has been passed in the last, not only, you know, when President Trump had a Republican House and Senate, but ever since he's had a Democratic House, you know, stuff does get done. And, you know, we have a professor here, Allison Craig, who studies the Congress and actually worked in Congress as a staff person for a long time. And she was having a conversation with us, and she said basically there's a lot of stuff that gets done. You know, we focus on areas where there is an impasse or there are problems. But so you guys are sitting out there kind of, I think you read the headlines and you wonder, gosh, I mean, does the federal government work at all? Well, there is some evidence that they do pass pieces of legislation, right? We just tend to emphasize those areas where there's most, you know, there's the most amount of conflict. Okay, so that's sort of point one. But the second point I would raise is that there is a distinction here between institutional tension and partisan tension. Any Congress is going to have some problems with the president because there's always a question about who has the most power, who ought to be acting under certain circumstances. We'll talk about this a little bit when we talk about economic policy in a few minutes. Right? So even if you have a Republican Congress and a Republican president, or Democratic Congress and Democratic president, they don't always see eye to eye, because the president wants to do certain things and the Congress wants to do certain things. So that's an institutional tension. There's also a partisan tension layered on top of that right now. So, you know, one thing you notice in the current situation is that because the Democrats control the House, they not only want to do certain things because, you know, they're members of the House and think they ought to be in charge of certain aspects of public policy, but they also have a very different idea in partisan and ideological terms than the president. So there's a partisan tension, Democrat, Republican, on top of the institutional tension. And, but I should specify, of course, what you have now is a situation of divided government. Anytime that one party controls, I should say, let's put it in the negative sense. When one party doesn't control all three elements, the two chambers of the House and Senate, two chambers of Congress, and the presidency, unless you're three for three, unless your party controls the presidency, the House, and the Senate, that's unified government. But if that's not the case, it's divided government. So right now, Republicans control the presidency and the Senate, not the House. The Democrats control the House. By definition, that's divided government. So anytime you're not three for three, you have divided government. It is the case that stuff gets done when they're under conditions of divided government, but it does seem to be a little tougher. So I wanted to say, you know, we talked about a couple of elements of this, but I want to say a few things specifically about the tension rising possibly to the point of impeachment. You know, we're reading the Constitution right now, and we're considering the debates that took place in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention about how to structure American government. And one thing, all right, so I'm in the minority on this, but I'll lay this out there for you. Right now, we're talking about the possibility that the House of Representatives would impeach President Trump. I actually think this is something, if you go back and you look at the debates that occurred in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention, it's pretty clear that the framers of the Constitution thought impeachment wouldn't be that unusual, that it was simply a power that Congress could wield to rein in the president. Now, impeachment, by the way, just mechanically, the House of Representatives has the power to impeach the president. That simply means that they refer the president's case to the Senate. The Senate, by constitutional definition, gets to vote on whether to remove the president from office. So if the House votes to impeach, the case goes to the Senate, and the Senate, with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding over the Senate, votes whether to remove the president from office. So it's a two-step, which is pretty cool in Texas, right? Now, as I said, I'm in the minority, which is, I don't think that impeachment, now, what are the grounds for impeachment? Basically, if you read the text of the Constitution, it says high crimes and misdemeanors. That's a specific phrase. What are high crimes and misdemeanors? Famous phrase from Gerald Ford, when Gerald Ford was a member of the House back in the early 70s. Gerald Ford said, it's whatever the House of Representatives says it is. All right? So right now, you have this investigation, you have this concluded investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia in the 2016 presidential campaign. Robert Mueller basically said, well, you know, there's not enough evidence to necessarily recommend prosecution. He also said the Justice Department doesn't provide grounds for prosecution of a sitting president, which is, by the way, is an interesting question about whether you can indict a sitting president. We'll set that aside. But Mueller basically threw it into the lap of the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice said, you know, we're not going to move forward with this. You know, it doesn't seem to be strong evidence, right? That's what they did, but the House of Representatives can take any information from the Mueller report or any other source of information that they want, and they could, if they so choose, vote to impeach President Trump for high crimes and misdemeanors by their definition. As I said, I just don't think impeachment is necessarily that big a deal. If this were to happen, now I understand practically it's a big deal, but constitutionally it's not, you know, something that seems to be thought of as unusual or particularly damning for the president. How would this play out if the Democrats in the House decided to impeach the president? Now the case would go to the Senate, and the Senate would almost certainly not vote to remove the president from office, right? So this is what happened with Bill Clinton. The House of Representatives voted to impeach Bill Clinton. It went to the Senate, and the Senate said it does not rise to a level that we think you should remove the president from office. So, you know, this has happened a couple times in American history, Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton. Richard Nixon, by the way, was not impeached. He resigned before the articles were voted on by the House of Representatives. So anyway, we're kind of talking about these things right now. It's a long-winded. I wanted to talk about kind of the mechanics of impeachment because I think that's important right now. This is an issue that's going to continue throughout this semester and probably deep into the summer. But it's a great time to connect that information, that news, with what we're, you know, reading and what we're experiencing in the beginning of this class, right? So take a look at your Constitution, you know, look at the powers of the Congress, reference to the powers of the president, this process by which presidents are impeached, and, you know, ask yourself, what do you think of what's going on right now? I mean, right now we're considering whether possibly obstruction of justice, that is President Trump's kind of lack of willingness to go along with the Mueller investigation, lack of willingness to have members of the administration testify in front of Congress. Is that obstruction of justice such that you think you would vote to impeach the president if you were sitting in the Congress? And if, you know, yes, what about in the Senate? If you were in the Senate, would you say, yeah, if this came to me, I think he should be removed of office because of the particular nature of what Trump has done, right? All of those are relevant questions. We want you guys thinking about those things because that's what makes a class like this fun, right? Putting yourself in the position of power, thinking about what these actors are doing and why they're doing what they're doing. You know, beyond the question of whether you think it's correct for Congress to impeach, if you were in Nancy Pelosi's shoes, the Speaker of the House, the Democratic leader of the House, would you do it politically? Is it a smart political move prior to the 2020 elections, right? So all of this comes in. I'll get out of this topic now. We got two other things we want to cover. We're not moving very quickly right now. We're on a glacial pace right now, but we'll speed it up to the next two. But this is what we want you to do this semester. And with the In the News assignments, this is what we want you to consider, right? We'll ask you questions about this, hopefully directly connecting some of the materials you're going over with what's happening in the news today. So let's move away from this Congress-President relationship right now. Let's talk about tariffs, trade wars. I want to say just a couple things about regulating tech. That's been in the news the last couple of days. So, Professor McDaniel, you're a public policy guy. Tell me a little bit about trade and tariffs.
So, one of the things, what I don't understand tariffs is that it's an additional fee that's given to some type of imported item. So, what you might find is that if you're trying to protect a certain industry within the U.S., so this happened with the automobile industry. If you want to protect the U.S. automobile industry, what you will do is assess an additional fee on vehicles that are brought in from overseas. So this is a kind of a classic example of tariffs. And so tariffs are in many ways used to try to increase the price of a certain good, with the belief being that if the price goes up, the demand will go down. And furthermore, that the demand for that product will go down, and that the individuals will demand a product that is a domestic product. So they will be less likely to demand an international product, more likely to demand an American-made product. So you can think about this in terms of avocados. All right, so you either get ones from California, or you get ones from Mexico. The idea is if there's a tariff, the ones from Mexico are going to be a little bit more expensive than the ones from California. And so this is how this all works in terms of affecting trade between countries. Because you want to protect domestic institutions. And so one of the ways you protect domestic institutions is by increasing the price on products from outside. So for instance, one of the reasons why there was a push for Hawaii to become a state is because they didn't want to pay the tariff associated with the sugar that was being made in Hawaii. So the Americans that were in Hawaii making sugar didn't like the tariff, so they said if we make Hawaii a state, the tariff goes away. And so tariffs are really a way of trying to adjust the how trade takes place and the demand for certain products. And so you're trying to increase demand for domestic products while decreasing demand for international products. And one of the ways to do this is by applying tariffs. As we know, price increases, demand decreases. Now, President Trump has applied this because he has really made the argument that the U.S. is in kind of upside down in some of the trade deals, and specifically in regards to China, he has raised certain tariffs. This has actually led to increased prices for, like, one thing in particular, solar panels. And so you find that people who are in the solar panel industry have actually been hurt by this, but also by farmers. And so there have been a couple of bills passed to bail out farmers because of the tariffs that President Trump has passed. mainly because President Trump has passed these tariffs, the countries in response pass other tariffs, which means that products that are being imported from the U.S. are now cost more in these other countries, which means there's a decreased demand, which means people in the U.S. Have lost buyers. So the producers have lost consumers. And so you see President Trump with multiple bills trying to bail out farmers who are, again, a part of his base. But in doing these tariffs, he may have helped out one part of his base, but hurt another part of his base. And again, this has created some level of complication. But again, President Trump is maybe argument that he's going to try to create better trade deals, which make the U.S. look better. I know he's repackaged some. A lot of people have argued that he's basically done the same thing as others, just renamed it. And it's not that different from what others had in the past. But right now, with the threats of tariffs with Mexico, there is a concern that, you know, you're seeing bipartisan voices in Congress expressing concern that tariffs against Mexico will basically tear apart a new trade deal between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And again, it's going to be important to see how this plays out and how this affects the economy in the long run, because again, it affects the products being brought in. So that means the price is going to go up for what we purchase. But then also, because we create these tariffs, other nations create tariffs, which means that there may be less consumption of U.S. goods. So the prices go up for the goods that we buy, and there may be less buyers for the products that we supply. And this becomes a tenuous situation where it could lead to some type of economic downfall. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen like all of a sudden the economy just bottoms out and we're in a Great Depression for 20 years. I'm not saying that, but there are clear consequences for these decisions. So what President Trump's saying is in the short term, this may be painful, but in the long term, we benefit from it, and we'll have to see how that works out.
Yeah, I'll be real brief on this. I think what I'd like to emphasize, as you guys, again, are kind of looking at the Constitution and trying to get a sense of, you know, based on the original text and the original conversations that occurred in Philadelphia, the relative powers allocated to the different players within the federal government and then between the federal government and the states. What's interesting here, I think, is the president's dominance over economic policy. If you read Article 2, it's not clear why it is that, you know, the president would be in charge of, you know, sort of formulating tariff policy and getting tariff policy, passed he doesn't get it passed into law. The president just sort of sets these tariffs. Congress is sort of missing in action here, which I think is really interesting, right? So if you're reading the Constitution and then you're looking at the headlines today and you're seeing, well, Trump conducts trade war with China, Trump conducts trade war with Mexico, you would be forgiven if you were to be at a loss to explain, how is it that the president actually kind of does all this? Isn't this Congress's province? You notice we don't conduct these policies via treaty with the advice and consent of the Senate. It seems to be kind of the president's, you know, personal playground. I don't mean that in a demeaning way. I just mean it's interesting the way public policy has evolved over time. I would also point out that one of the reasons for establishing a stronger federal government back in the late 1700s was to conduct trade and to develop a national economy instead of having 13, you know, states that were loosely confederal and negotiating their own deals with different countries. You know, it was thought that it would be much smarter, much stronger, would facilitate much greater economic development if the United States was acting according to a single voice. And we still see that today. So, you know, Hamilton and others who advocated strongly for, the new Constitution, Madison, John Jay, et cetera, they did so primarily on the basis of economic reality. And this resonates today, you know, the president conducting these things and trying to set the tone. I also wanted to point out just, this isn't so much a trade war thing, but in the news headlines this last week was the notion that the Justice Department was going to be considering anti-monopoly or antitrust legislation, or action, I should say, not legislation, against tech giants like Amazon and Apple. And this is another thing I'll just throw out there for you guys to consider. If you look at the Constitution, it's interesting to kind of ponder what legal justification the United States government has to go after large businesses or large corporations for monopolistic practices. By the way, I'm not suggesting they don't have that right. That right has evolved over time, however. There were no businesses of anything like this kind of magnitude in 1789. There were certainly no corporations back in the day. But over the course of U.S. history, you know, whether it's the steel companies or the rail companies, the railroads in particular, you've had the development of these monopolies. And there's been a kind of a long-standing question about the extent to which the federal government can act to regulate, let alone to break up, but even to regulate these large corporations and businesses. So I'll just put that out there and get that on your radar screen as well, thinking about, you know, what is the justification for the federal government to regulate the practices of these large corporations? Is it a good thing? Do you think it is constitutional? Okay.
And I think one of the things that's important to note is if you look at the late 19th century, the railroad, regulating the railroad industry was a big thing. And I think as you go further along in Professor Shaw's discussion of parties, and he talks about the party coalitions, that'll be a big thing about, okay, how do we regulate the railroads? And I think for us to kind of understand how we might deal with these big companies now, we may want to see how we handle the railroads more than 100 years ago. And it's important to note that not only is the U.S. concerned about this, but you're seeing companies such as Google and others in European courts being found of violating antitrust laws. And so it may just be that the U.S. is following a trend that other countries have followed in terms of these tech giants, with the idea that they may have sucked up so much that they've kind of cut out competition. And this may be bad activity.
That's the key, the notion that they stifle competition. When we say a monopoly, when we say a cartel, we're talking about corporations that are so large that they completely dominate a sector of the economy, and that's a bad thing. So back in the railroad days, you know, what happened was there were certain railroads that dominated everything, and they just set the rates, and they set them as high as they wanted, and they were so dominant and so stifling on the economy that pressure on the federal government to act was extreme. Have we reached that point today with Amazon, with Apple, right? Are they so dominant that we think the federal government needs to step in? And if so, what is the constitutional basis for the government to act?
And you've seen some action with Microsoft, specifically with Microsoft Explorer, the browsers, certain things like that, where they've kind of set things up to prevent any type of competition. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this takes shape, because this is the new big boom industry. Right. So we think about the railroads, think about the steel companies, and now it's the tech companies.
Well, then there's even softer questions like social media. So you have a company like Facebook. Mm. Well, Facebook is so dominant in that area that there are people who think that the Federal Communications Commission ought to regulate content on Facebook the way that the FCC regulates broadcast airwaves, right? The notion is there are public airwaves. The federal government has the right to monitor them and to set certain terms in order to get a license to use those airwaves. Well, we don't do that with social media, should we? Right? And it's a very interesting question, at least. So let's move to our third and final topic and get you guys out of here for the week. We're going to talk about abortion, and we're going to talk about, in particular, recently, abortion has been in the news because several states have passed very restrictive laws on abortion, most notably Alabama. Georgia has a restrictive law. At the other end of the spectrum, you have legislation pending in Virginia and in New York. And I said the other end of the spectrum because they, you know, sort of really codified not simply a woman's right to choose, which is constitutionally established, but the right to, you know, carry a pregnancy all the way to term, and then protecting the woman's right with her doctor to choose up to the moment of birth sort of whether a pregnancy would be terminated. So that's kind of at one end of the spectrum. And then the Alabama and Georgia laws are at the other end, where a woman's right to choose is effectively curtailed after conception. You know, what are we doing here? And I thought Roe v. Wade established this right. Now, that's all really interesting public policy. Professor McDaniel, I want to talk about kind of, you know, the federal government, the state government, and the court's role here. So, you know,
I guess what's important to note is the Alabama law has been signed. I think the Georgia law has not been signed
yet. Still pending, right?
It's still pending.
And we should point out, so let's set the table here real briefly. Roe versus Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision on abortion, basically said that the states do not have the right to undercut a woman's right to an abortion. That is a matter of, that is constitutionally protected. Now, you might be saying, well, where in the Constitution is that right? The court said there is an implicit right to privacy embodied by the Constitution and the other rights in the Bill of Rights and beyond. So even though there's no explicit right to privacy, say the way there's a right to free speech, you can't have these other rights, the court said, without the right to privacy being assumed. And that right to privacy protects a woman's right to choose. That's the basis. So because of that, you do not have any congressional legislation establishing a woman's right to choose. And at the so the Congress hasn't acted to protect this because they don't have to. The states, however, have essentially kind of nibbled away, some pro, some con, on this notion of a woman's right to choose. And that's where we are right now. So, you know, the question then, or the question we'll pose to you all is, how do you feel? If the court were to, and it's a more conservative court now, if the court were to overturn Roe v. Wade, to say that, nah, the previous courts were wrong, there is no right to privacy in the Constitution, therefore, now, I should sort of point out, what would happen in that case? Well, what would happen is the legislatures would need to get involved. Both the national legislature, the Congress, which could immediately, if they so choose, pass a law protecting a woman's right to choose, right? That's one option. The states could and almost certainly would get in on the act. That is, they would more forcefully determine the right of a woman to choose or to restrict a woman's right to choose in different states. So, you know, if this to us is fascinating from a political science point of view because it involves questions of the court really back in the 1970s with the Roe decision stepping in and making a very, very important public policy decision.
Yes.
Right? Instead of, you know, the legislative bodies. And the legislative bodies kind of taken a back seat, although now the legislatures at the state level, here's where federalism comes in, have begun to kind of really chip away at that. So what do we do? Now, by the way, the dynamic here is that the state legislatures, you could argue, have strategically passed very restrictive abortion laws in order to get sued, in order to get the case to the Supreme Court, in order to press the issue on the court possibly revisiting Roe versus Wade, right? So, you know, you could argue that some of the legislation is actually, in fact, designed to trigger the court to reconsider these. Now, the court seems to be completely uninterested in taking this unless it absolutely has to. This is just kind of my insight. I don't think John Roberts, you know, we talk about the court leaning conservative now with more Republican appointees than Democratic. On the other hand, there's an institutional interest that the court has in not doing things that are very controversial, that are going to antagonize a large portion of the population and erode the kind of credibility of the court. So I don't think the court really wants to take these sorts of cases, but they may have to.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about Bush v. Gore decision, Citizens United, the decision regarding the ACA, gay marriage.
Right, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
That the court has been put in this situation. And you saw individuals really take a very strong stance of how we have these unelected individuals making these decisions. And so you see the court being attacked when it's not making decisions that it's taken aside on a controversial decision. And I think what's important to note is the court, again, has stayed away from certain things. And the court did allow, there's one state that required that after an abortion, the body must be either buried or cremated. And so the court allowed that to stay. The court has kind of pushed back on certain ones. But one of the things we'll notice, if that Roe v. Wade is struck down, we should expect to basically have two Americas in regards to abortion rights. Now, some states have even tried to go as far as saying that if you get an abortion in another state and come back, you can't be prosecuted. I think that will run into some problems. That's an attempt to challenge the court. But it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And again, abortion has been around for years, hundreds and thousands of years. But as far as a hot button political issue, it's really taken shape really in kind of the mid-70s, probably the past 40 to 50 years, has really taken kind of a center stage in terms of understanding the cleavages in society and the partisan cleavages.
It's become a linchpin issue as the religious right has risen. That's not to say it wasn't controversial, but as Professor McDaniel said, in a lot of countries for a lot of, you know, contemporary history, I say contemporary going back couple thousand years, it's been sort of an accepted practice. But things have changed. That's not to defend it or to attack it. It's things have changed, and you know, clearly right now, Professor McDaniel and I made the case early in the class that Congress seems to be able to, in some instances, legislate, right? Yeah. Despite the partisan differences that are so much at play these days. If Roe v. Wade were overturned, the ability of the federal Congress, the U.S. Congress, to act, to step into that vacuum and pass a law of some sort, you know, defining abortion rights in the United States, that one I'm not so sure how that works out, or if they could. And if they don't, or I should say, if they were not able to, then you'd have this, what we call patchwork quilt of laws existing, driven by state legislative decisions and politics. And, you know, I mean, Professor McDaniel says it bluntly, right, that you could have two Americas, right, where states like that are more conservative, like Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia, would have one set of abortion laws, and New York and California would have others. And that's a distinct possibility, which is another reason why I think the court is very sensitive to this, and I think would be very reluctant to go full force after Roe v. Wade. But I've been wrong so many times on this stuff, I hesitate to predict anything, you know. But at any rate, so again, we understand that for some of this is sort of sensitive kind of conversation, but it's important, right, that this is a class in government, and, you know, we think there are going to be a lot of issues, not necessarily that we'll discuss, but a lot of issues that come up in the context of American politics where there are questions of federalism, there are questions of the appropriate branch of government setting out public policy. Is it the court, is it the president, the Congress? And we want to emphasize those things. So when you guys take a look at what's on the news feed, you know, you can have hopefully kind of a deeper appreciation for these issues as opposed to, you know, just the particular information you get on a given day.
Yes.
Yeah. So with that, are we good?
Yeah, we're great.
All right, we got one in the can. We will see you next week on In the News.
The Government 310 In the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.